Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast. I'm Alex Schumacher. I don't know about you, but I know that my knowledge of science is, well, probably not as thorough as it should be. Luckily for me, and hopefully some of you, Real College Podcast is spending the next two episodes looking at the world of science. So dust off your beakers, throw on your old lab coat, and sit back and relax, because Real College Podcast is putting science under our journalistic microscopes. If you're like me, you heard about them a few years ago and have since sort of forgotten about them. But while we've all forgotten about the possibilities of 3D printers, researchers here at the University of Minnesota have been exploring just some of the possibilities offered by 3D printing. Ben Hallam has more.
So at the University of Minnesota here, what we're doing is we're building 3D printers that can print a range of materials that we call functional materials. So basically what that means is if you go out and buy a 3D printer now, it pretty much can only print one thing, which is a hard plastic. The printers that we build can print many different types of materials. So that can be electronic materials, cells, combinations of electronics with cells for bionic applications, and soft materials, not hard plastics, but soft materials too. So many different types of materials. In fact, every type of functionality you can think of, we can probably print. So it really expands the scope of—
That's Michael McAlpine, an associate professor of mechanical engineering here at the University of Minnesota. Along with his research group, he's been developing new functional materials and devices that can be created with 3D printing technology, leading the way to the next generation of 3D printing.
This opens up all kinds of new applications that basically sets the stage for an exciting future. I do think 3D printing is not overhyped. I think that there's actually, when you start to open up the types of materials that it can print, there's all kinds of things that you can do with it, all kinds of applications that you can envision. So I'll give you a few examples. We've already published in very diverse areas. So we publish in things like using 3D printing for nerve regeneration. We're working on 3D printing for spinal cord repair. We've published on 3D printed electronic devices that just, you don't need any type of specialized electronic materials. You just take the printer and some raw materials and suddenly you have an electronic gadget that can do things like sense touch or sense temperature. Biomedical devices and electronics are all being 3D printed from our printers. So most recently, actually, what we did is we printed organ models that feel like the actual organs themselves for surgical rehearsal.
How did you develop these organ models, and what makes them more useful than other types of surgical rehearsal?
Yeah, so these organ models are made out of soft material. So a big problem in the medical industry are medical errors, surgical errors. These are called never events, things that should never happen. You hear about them all the time, like the doctor amputates the wrong leg or a mistake is performed during surgery. Now, one of the nice things about 3D printing is it allows you to take MRI scans and CAT scans and convert them into a 3D model, because right now the doctors rely on these scans, but they're two-dimensional flat images, and so they have to piece together in their mind what the three-dimensional organ looks like. We actually, since our engineering school is right across the street from the medical school here at the University of Minnesota, we can actually go right across the street, get some real prostate tissue samples from patients, and take those tissue samples and do mechanical tests on them and determine exactly what they feel like, exactly their mechanical properties, and then 3D print soft organ models from soft polymers that replicate exactly the mechanical properties of the original organ itself. So these are patient-specific prostate models that look exactly like the prostate, because we use the patient's MRI scan, and they feel like you're holding an organ in your hand, even though it's just a polymer, and it allows you to cut into it, suture it, plan your surgery, better. And we've given it to some surgeons on campus, and they were amazed at how realistic these things felt and how you could suture them, but they still held together. You could do all your planning on these really simple, cheap models that we just print from our printers here.
Professor McAlpine's work goes beyond just organ models to actual biomedical devices which can be used to treat patients who have suffered nerve damage and promote nerve regeneration with the use of 3D printing.
For us, the big one that we're working on, the big space that we sort of started ourselves, is this neural regeneration. So that includes regeneration of both peripheral nerves and central nerve, meaning the spinal cord. So the spinal cord is your part of your central nervous system, the brain and the spinal cord. And then the nerves travel out and they travel down your arms and legs. That's called the peripheral nervous system. So we started off with the peripheral nervous system because that's a little bit easier to tackle. You can print little devices that conform to the shape of these growing nerves and provide little pathways for the nerves to grow in. And then the nerves spontaneously regenerate. So the nice thing about peripheral nerves is they kind of grow like weeds, you know. So as long as you put a scaffold in there, then it'll guide the nerve. But from there, we're actually starting to work on the central nerve, the spinal cord, which is a much harder problem. And as you know, spinal cord injury is a debilitating injury where someone could completely lose the ability to walk and even move their arms. That's a huge problem. That's a big problem. And we like to work on big problems. And what the 3D printing provides you is it provides you the ability to print a scaffold to help regenerate the axons in the spinal cord. We can also print cells within the scaffold. We've actually shown we can print neurons in the scaffold, neuron stem cells that differentiate into real neurons, and then sprout axons in order to form these reconnections that allow the brain to communicate with the rest of the body again. And so we've done that, and now the next step is to start to implant these things into rats and show that we really can help rats walk again if they have spinal cord injury or peripheral nerve injury. So I think that's a huge space. Not many people are working on it, surprisingly, but I think 3D printing is the key tool that will help revolutionize those areas.
As the functionality of 3D printers continues to expand, Professor McAlpine sees their use going beyond just specific medical devices or industrial functions to a common household item that can do almost anything and that almost everyone will want to own.
And so what I think the future is that people are going to be able to 3D print biomedical devices directly on their body or electronic gadgets directly on their arm straight from the printer. And I think once we can go beyond this space of, you know, just hard plastic toward more functional materials and devices, then I think everyone is going to want to buy one of these printers and everyone is going to want to print electronics on their body. Everyone's going to want to print their own pharmaceutical drugs, their own food, everything, you know, once you can expand the capabilities of these printers. So I do think this is the next big revolution, but I think we need to do a lot of work on in terms of what the printers can do before that happens.
3D printing holds the promise to revolutionize fields as disparate as medicine, manufacturing, and consumer electronics. And some of the research that is going to bring that revolution is happening right here at the University of Minnesota. For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
The creation of the birth control pill was a major medical breakthrough. It was far more reliable and unobtrusive than anything that had come before it. However, the scientific discovery alone wouldn't have been much without changes brought by the feminist movement and feminist activism. Here's Liv Riggins with more.
I sat down with Dr. Elaine May, a professor at the University of Minnesota and author of America and the Pill, to talk about how the most popular form of contraception available today came to be.
There were two women who were behind the development of the birth control pill initially. Margaret Sanger, who had been a birth control activist since the 1910s and teens, and a friend and colleague of hers by the name of Catherine McCormick, who was a wealthy widow. In fact, McCormick was one of the first women to graduate from MIT, and she had a degree in biology, so she was actually a scientist and had a lot of money at her disposal to invest in research and development for an oral contraceptive. Now, these two women had been friends and colleagues in the women's movement since the years before the vote, and together they found a team of a small team of scientists and clinical researchers who they then funded with McCormick's money to develop the prototype of a birth control pill. At the time, pharmaceutical companies were not interested because they were afraid that they would be considered immoral, that the Catholic Church might boycott them. They were concerned because the federal government was not interested in investing in the development of an oral contraception method. And even the President of the United States in the 1950s, Dwight D. Eisenhower, said this is not the concern of the government to be involved in something like this. Birth control has nothing to do with the government. He changed his mind later on. But at that time, no. So where was the money going to come from? And so it was really these two women working with interested scientists who got the ball rolling before either the government or the pharmaceutical industry would get involved. And it's ironic because, of course, pharmaceutical companies made millions of dollars off the pill, but at the time they were afraid to invest in it. The pill was approved by the federal government, by the Food and Drug Administration, in 1960. And that's when it became legally on the market and available. But at that time, it was still unavailable in many states where birth control was illegal. But there were loopholes. Even though in some cases it was against the law for doctors to prescribe or women to use birth control, or men for that matter, doctors could prescribe birth control methods, even before the pill, if they felt that it was important to do so for the health and benefit of the woman. In other words, if a doctor said it would not be in the best interest of this woman's health to get pregnant.
Now, the first two children you'd had they been taken away from you?
Yes, because I couldn't take care of them by myself, and I couldn't with my husband.
And now I believe you had one more, and it was also put out for adoption, wasn't it?
Yes, I put it out because of my husband.
Now, after you were unable to get the abortion for the fourth pregnancy,
they could then prescribe and approve birth control and contraceptive methods. And so women were very, very good at finding doctors who would prescribe birth control methods for them before and after the pill was approved. It remained illegal in many states until 1965, when the Supreme Court ruled that married couples had to have access to contraception and that states could not prevent that. But that was just for married people. And it wasn't until the early 1970s that another court case ruled that anyone, married or not, had to have access and that states could not prevent anyone from gaining access to contraceptives.
The majority in cases from Texas and Georgia said that the decision belongs to the woman and her doctor, not the government.
Thus, the anti-abortion and give her freedom of choice in this area is an extraordinary event. And I think that January 22nd...
But by that time, the pill had been available, and of course other methods of contraception had been available too.
Although there were other forms of contraception available at the time, the pill became one of the most popular and the most famous, and remains the most popular form of contraception today. Dr. May sees four major reasons for why the pill in particular made a difference.
When the pill was approved in 1960, there were things about the pill that made it different than other forms of contraception. The first was that it removed the act of birth control from the act of sex. So you could take the pill and there would be no interruption to the sex act. Any other form of birth control was a mechanical form that influenced and affected people's spontaneity and ability to have uninhibited or uninterrupted sexual contact without concern about conception. So that was the first thing. Second thing was that the birth control pill put the put women in complete control of contraception, and that was a first. They didn't have to ask the permission of their sexual partner. Their sexual partner didn't even have to know, because it was in women's control. They could take the pill daily at a time that was not connected to their sexual activity, And so women for the first time had complete control, and their sexual partner had no control and in some cases not even any knowledge. And the third and perhaps most important difference with the birth control pill compared to other forms of contraception is that it was almost 100% effective if used properly. And there was no other form of birth control that was that effective. So those were the three things about the pill that made it different. Now, what made the pill really have an impact socially? It was the feminist movement. Because if there had been no feminist movement, the pill would have been a great advance in contraception. But it wouldn't have necessarily contributed to a great advance for women. Because if there were still so many doors closed to women, whether or not they could control their fertility would not have had any impact on what opportunities were available to them in their lives. New doors were opening up for education, for higher education, for professional training, for new kinds of careers that had been closed off to women in the past, public life, etc. And it was the feminist movement that pushed all those doors open. And the pill allowed women to walk through those doors.
For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Lily Briggins.
Science doesn't just magically happen. Real people spend real time and energy on making breakthroughs that we all take for granted happen. And as many of you unfortunately know, people are not always treated equally, and unfortunately, this unequal treatment extends into science as well. I looked at the problems faced particularly by queer individuals hoping to have a career in science. If you wander around Smith Hall on the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus long enough, you're going to see stickers by some of the chemistry department faculty's doors. Stickers have a rainbow flag on one side and then spell the word ally using the symbol for aluminum to spell the first part of the word. These stickers aren't just a way for professors to show off that they're a great ally of the LGBT community. These stickers have a much deeper purpose than that. Created by Professor Arlie Penn, these stickers symbolize that the bear has been to a session teaching them about intersectionality and diversity, and that the bear understands where they can help and not help students coming to them with diversity issues. Penn explains why this is so important.
I have a very candid conversation with anybody wanting to display a sticker on what do people expect when they see the sticker. You know, because I see that sticker and what do I assume? I assume a level of competence. I assume that I'm going to come into a space where somebody is knowledgeable in how to treat me with respect and how to use the correct pronouns when referring to me and all that kind of stuff. And so you have to feel like you can actually do most of that. And for those things that you don't know how to do, you have to be in touch with what you don't know how to do and be honest about it.
As chairperson of the chemistry department's diversity committee, Penn talked about the changes that they've seen happen in science over the years as a whole and other programs working to help queer scientists and science students.
So there's all these like business as usual day-to-day things that have changed a lot. And then there's also bigger picture things that have changed a lot in terms of the visibility of queer scientists and engineers nationwide, but also at the University of Minnesota that students get to see every day. And they start to see people like them succeeding. And I think that's a beautiful thing. OSTEM, which is out in science and technology, engineering and math, runs a mentoring program so you can get paired up with a queer mentor, which I think is huge because, like, how do you navigate if you're pre-transition, for example? How do I navigate my transition while I'm a student in science and engineering? Or let's say I'm a grad student and I'm actively a teaching assistant and I'm about to start my transition. How do I do that? How do I do that in a way that's professional? What if? All the what if questions, you know, start to come into play. And you have somebody you can sound things off of who are in the field. I think that makes a big difference.
Outside of programs directed just towards college students, Queer Science is a program directed towards queer high school students with an interest in STEM fields. Julie Johnson, a PhD student at the University of Minnesota, heads Queer Science and talked about its impact.
So at this point, we've been running Queer Science for about a year, and it's been really exciting, especially just to watch it grow into a bigger program, where we started off, our first event only had 4 students show up, and 3 of them at least repeated the next time because they were so excited to come back. And a lot of them are staying in touch to make sure that we at least know what universities they want to go to or what fields they're looking at. So it's been really nice to see that they are getting super engaged and trying to just talk to us about science and keep us in the loop, that we're not, they considered us part of like their friends and like their connections.
All these programs and actions mark a step forward in STEM's attitude and treatment of queer individuals. Penn talked about some of these changes in attitude over the years.
I would say that 10 years ago, the big going kind of mantra was don't ask, don't tell. If you were not cisgender and straight, you were expected to basically be silent. So you'd go to a study group, for example, and people would talk about their weekends. And if your weekend involved your queer identity, then you didn't talk about it. You were a silent member of that study group, and you lose out on opportunities then to connect with your fellow students and all that kind of stuff. Same thing with conferences, same thing with like work dinners and all that stuff. Everybody talks about their lives. Oh, what did you and your wife do? You know? And it results in a very strong sense of isolation, I think, for a lot of science and engineering type people, because they can't talk about their lives, right? And then the shift has been towards kind of treating people who do science and engineering as actual whole people, as opposed to just scientists and engineers. And if they don't come in that standard cisgender straight man model, it's becoming better and more okay, and you can actually talk about your life. So that's coming. Are we there yet? We're not there yet, 100%, because they're always like residual old school attitudes that are still hanging on, but we're getting there. It's getting better.
But while things are getting better, those lingering old attitudes still have a serious effect on queer students caught in their crossfire. Johnston told me about one such incident from when she first arrived at the University of Minnesota.
As a PhD student, I get assigned an office, and one of the first days that I had at the University of Minnesota, the person who was assigning offices apparently went around and asked, hey, this is Julie, she's trans, are you comfortable with having a trans person as your office mate? And you would never see somebody go around and be like, hey, this is Johnny, Johnny's a black person, are you okay with a black person as your office mate? And thankfully my office mate was really wonderful and one of my best friends now, but it was just like a complete lack of training and awareness on how to handle that. This is private information that I did not come out to any of these people as trans or whatever, and you should not be revealing this to the public like that.
As my conversation with Penn drew to a close, he told me about an incident of discrimination they too faced back in their days as a student.
When I was a grad student, there was one research group that I was thinking about joining, and there was a member of that research group who knew I was queer, and he went to the PI of that research group and said that if I joined the group, he would leave the group because he didn't want to work with no queer person. And I found out about that, and I was like, well, obviously that's not a group or an environment that I want to be in. And I love science. I'm not so particular about exactly what science I do. I love it all. And so I just ruled them out. That was in, what year would that have been, like 1992? I haven't heard stories like that happening now. Actually, there is one story that was relatively recent. We had our prospective graduate student weekend. I think it was like 2 years ago. And one of the prospective graduate students who came to visit shared with his host that he was appalled to see all the ally stickers on people's doors and why it was such a queer-friendly department and how clearly it was not a good fit for him. And you know what my response to that is? He's right. So he went to a different university that I shall not disclose the name of, but you know, I mean, it actually kind of goes both ways, right? We're sending a signal to queer people that we're an inclusive space, but we're also sending a signal to people who are not queer that we are an inclusive space and we have expectations.
From Real College Podcast, I'm Alex Schumacher. That's all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast, but we've got more stories about the world of science coming your way very soon. Real College Podcast is produced by me, Alex Schumacher, Liv Riggins, and Ben Hallam. Our managing editor is the one, the only, Jacob Maldonado Medina. Real College Podcast is produced by Radio K, and you can hear us there every Monday and Saturday. Or you can find us online at radiok.org or wherever you get your podcasts from. Also, if you enjoy the show, you should definitely leave us a rating on iTunes. It helps other people find the show. Thanks for listening, and tune in next week for more stories about science.